Hello, everyone. Welcome to Ecosystemic Futures, the podcast. I'm your host, Diane Finkhausen, former GE business leader turned podcast host, an expert advisor on ecosystem transformation. As our world is becoming increasingly digital and connected, ecosystemic models are reshaping the fundamental frameworks within society, industry, economy, and policy. Systems of interconnected networks are blurring the boundaries that used to define economic sectors and supply chains, and reframing how we innovate and build for the future. In this podcast, we'll explore some of these new ecosystemic impacts, how the world is changing, and how we consider approaches to decisioning for greater ecosystem wellness. We'll explore the impacts across every facet of society, from the future of education, work, agriculture, engineering, and space, just to name a few. To set the stage for the global experts and luminaries who will join us throughout this series, Round Zero is our discussion today of our current economic framework, the potential ecosystemic impacts, and what these might look like in the years and decades ahead. I'm thrilled to be joined by our brilliant panel of co-hosts in this discussion today, and let's pass the mic around to let them introduce themselves. Ed, over to you.
Hi, I'm Min Powell. I'm the CEO of TensorX. We sit at the intersection of the cloud, the crowd, and AI to drive innovation in everything from supply chains to space networks. And I'll pass it down to James.
Hi, I'm James Villarubia, current Presidential Innovation Fellow with NASA, former startup and government policy wonk, and interested in sort of exploring the impact of AI and digital spaces on the economy and our future. And pass it over to Vic.
Thanks, James. Vic, been at NASA for 15 years. My background's in propulsion, biomimicry, and futuring. Currently working as the mapping lead for the Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project within the Aeronautics Mission of NASA, and interested in better understanding societal problems and perspectives from various thought leaders. And pass it over to Marco.
Hello, everyone. Thanks, Vic. Marco Annunziata, I'm a PhD in economics. I started my career in policy with the International Monetary Fund. Then I worked in finance for about 10 years and then moved to industry with General Electric, where I was the chief economist and head of business innovation strategy. It was the time when GE was getting deep into digital industrial, so that's where I developed my passion for the intersection of global economic trends and technological innovation. I've been a member of the Board of Advisors on Information Technology at Japan's Ministry of Economy, Trade and Industry. Now I run my own independent consultancy, and I'm a visiting faculty at Singapore Management University, and I'm delighted to be here with you guys.
Thanks, Marco, and thank you all for joining us today. Very excited about our conversation. So let's dive in. The state of play in our economy has become more fragile and more volatile. And it appears that this might be very well be the case for the foreseeable future. We're seeing heightened economic uncertainty with recession fears and questions regarding unemployment, supply chains, and stock market performance. I'm thrilled that Marco is here today to help us unpack some of the critical factors and make sense of the path ahead. So Marco, let's open things up here and dive in. Marco, you maintain a healthy skepticism regarding some of the economic policies that governments have run over the past 15 years. Why is that? Haven't these policies helped us survive a global financial crisis and a pandemic?
They have, but the policies of the last 15 years have basically focused on central banks driving interest rates to zero, injecting a lot of liquidity in the economy, and governments spending more and more money. And yes, they have helped us survive the global financial crisis and the pandemic. But let me first give you a couple of important caveats, and then my main criticism, the reason why I'm skeptical of these policies. My first caveat is that the two economic shocks, the pandemic and the global financial crisis, were not really shocks. We brought them upon ourselves. The global financial crisis was caused by several years of low interest rates that boosted asset prices and allowed leverage in the financial system to build up to dangerous levels. So the pandemic, shutting down the global economy during the pandemic, for me was a catastrophic mistake. It was crazy. There is now mounting evidence that the lockdowns were at best useless from a public health perspective and enormously damaging to the economy and to the education system and so to future generations. But we shut down the economy partly because we thought we could afford to, because policymakers had gotten in this frame of mind where they thought we could compensate the absence of private activity temporarily with massive public spending and even looser monetary policy without consequences. Now, over the past decade and a half, policymakers have been obsessed with the idea that the main problem in the economy was insufficient demand. And so you address the problem in their mind by stimulating demand with low interest rates, more liquidity, more government spending. In fact, some famous economists have been arguing that with interest rates so low, governments would have been mad not to borrow more and spend more. But what is the result? In the last 15 years, U.S. public debt as a proportion of GDP has doubled to 120%. In most other advanced countries, it has gone up a lot similarly, yet living standards measured by real per capita income have increased very little, just 1% in the U.S., less in other countries. And they have actually stagnated or shrunk in some of the countries with the highest debt buildup. Not only that, but potential growth, so the maximum speed at which our economies are expected to grow over the coming years, has gone down. So these policies have left us with more debt, lower growth, more inequality, vulnerable financial system, and all this because we've been fixated on demand rather than on supply, which is how you create growth and wealth. So this is why I remain very skeptical.
Despite all that, it sounds like from the sort of the position that a lot of prominent economists are taking today is that we're going to head back to an era of low inflation and low interest rates. Is that something you see, or do you disagree with that?
I completely disagree. I realize that I'm contradicting some very famous names in economics. You have economists like Larry Summers at Harvard, Olivier Blanchard at MIT. They've argued that advanced economies are in a situation that they call secular stagnation. So it's a situation where essentially populations are saving too much, investing too little. So the excess of savings and lack of consumption pushes down inflation. And the excess of savings over investment opportunities pushes down interest rates. And if that is true, then excess savings, so this level of savings that exceeds both actual investment and investment opportunities, are the root of the problem, and they should push us towards low inflation and low interest rates in the near future. However, I disagree for the following reasons. Mostly, I think the data contradict this theory completely. In advanced economies, excess savings are a very recent phenomenon. For most of the last 40 years, investment exceeded savings, not the other way around. Now, Blanchard and Summers would say, well, it's recent, but now it will go on for a very long time because now you have population aging. And as populations age, people have to live for longer in retirement, so they save more to provide for a longer retirement. But again, populations have been aging for the last several decades. And if you look at the numbers, in advanced economies, household savings have not risen at all. In fact, if I take the countries with the most extreme aging of populations, like Japan and Italy, savings have gone down. So the facts and the data seem to disprove this idea. And so I think the reason why we had low inflation and low interest rates are low inflation because globalization brought a lot of labor force, new labor force from China and other emerging markets into the global economy. And so this excess labor allowed us to push prices down and to keep inflation under control, even as loose monetary policy by central bankers was pushing interest rates down. Now the conditions have changed, however. Demand has recovered, partly because of loose government policies, as we discussed earlier. Supply lagged behind because we have not invested enough. And so I think now it's going to be a lot harder to push inflation down to the target of 2%. And if that is true, then monetary policy needs to be tighter, which is one reason to expect higher interest rates. And the other reason to expect higher interest rates is that there is a lot more need for investment today. Think of the green transition. Think of the need to upgrade infrastructure in the US and other advanced economies. Think of the need to potentially increase defense spending for higher geopolitical risk. And so more investment would need more demand for capital, which would push up higher interest rates. Now, just one more consideration on this, because so I don't feel completely alone on this side of the argument. Luckily, another famous economist, Ken Rogoff, who was one of my PhD advisors, has recently published a long-term study of interest rates, which looks back at the last 700 years. And his conclusion is that the last 10, 15 years of low interest rates really look like an anomaly, which is overdue for a correction back to higher interest rates. So I side with my old thesis advisor.
Historically, there have been periods where inflation has remained high. Are there any new risks or things that may repeat in terms of elevated inflation rates going forward?
It's a very, very good question, Vic, because we've had periods of high inflation in the past, but the last ones were in the 70s and 80s, so it was a very different economy. So the normal risk you would expect from high inflation are that high, and by the way, when I think high inflation, I don't think inflation going back to 8-9% or double digits. I think inflation, say, getting entrenched at 4-5% rather than the 2% target. The traditional risks you would think of is that people get used to a higher rate of inflation, and so producers say, well, this is what's going to happen to my input prices, so I systematically increase my prices by 5 or even 6%, try to get ahead of it. And then, especially with labor markets so tight, you might eventually get labor upping their wage negotiations to get ahead and trying to prevent, to stop this trend of the last 2 years where real wages have been constantly eroded. If that happens, then you can have inflation actually increasing and certainly inflation becoming more volatile. And the cost of it is it becomes a lot harder for companies and for households to make their economic planning. Now, I think this is still the bigger risk we are facing right now. I think the other risk is how the financial system reacts, because one difference from the past is that the financial system has now been used to very low interest rates, essentially for most of the working life of the bulk of the current workforce in the financial system. So investors, traders, they haven't really seen anything else. So we're under risk of greater instability and greater adjustments in the financial system, which in turn can be disruptive to economic growth. So I think, to me, these are the bigger risks. And I think, if you want, another consideration here is issues of income inequality, because a situation of high inflation either results in runaway wage price spiral, where wages try to get ahead of prices and vice versa, or it ends up in a situation of erosion of wages, and so impoverishment potentially of the most vulnerable sector of the working population. These, I think, are the biggest risks if we don't bring inflation back under control.
So Marco, what do you think the impact of higher interest rates will be on the appetite of governments for spending?
The appetite of governments for spending remains insatiable. I think that the right reaction should be for governments to say, okay, it's time to tighten budgets and prioritize spending. But I generally don't think this will happen. I think we are now in a situation where government has become more popular, partly because what we've seen over the past couple of decades, you know, Diane also referred to it, the global financial crisis, various hiccups, the increase in income inequality that I referred to earlier, they've increased the criticism of capitalism and the free market. And they've brought us to a situation where there is more tolerance or more support for greater government involvement in the economy and higher government expenditure. And so my concern is that government expenditure has now become a way of life. And instead of having governments saying, well, now we can't borrow cheaply anymore, so we should reduce spending, the solution, the reaction of governments will be, on the one hand, to actually tolerate higher inflation for a while longer, because it's a way of reducing the real value of debt. And on the other hand, to keep spending and to increase taxes to compensate for the higher spending. And if we go that route, my perspective is the biggest risk is it will lead us to even weaker economic growth.
So maybe, yeah, just done on that, Marco, if we think that through, what are the implications for sustainability, right, within the economy and perhaps some of the measures that might strengthen the resilience of the economy?
I think the implications for sustainability are very interesting. I think one way of looking at it is that there will be a reality check on green policies, because while you are telling Ed that the reaction of governments will be to keep spending and probably increase taxes to keep up with it, nonetheless, in a situation of higher interest rates, especially if growth weakens, there will be more attention to how we spend the money. And if not at the government level, certainly from a private sector perspective. So take the situation for financial investors, for example. In a situation like we had over the last 10 years, with asset prices going up always under all circumstances all the time, then it was easier for financial investors to embrace the idea of green investment. If we now get into a situation of where getting returns is much more difficult, I think investors, financial investors, will be a lot more reluctant to sacrifice returns for the sake of doing good with green investments. So there may be negative implications on funding for the green transition. Also, I think there is a risk that some governments at least will feel squeezed and so will be less generous with the green subsidies. Some governments will have no choice. There will be, in general, more attention to the actual costs of the energy transition. We already see a dramatic example of it with Germany reopening coal stations, coal power stations, in response to the energy crisis that they've suffered with the reduction of gas imports from Russia. And so I think there is a reality check coming from the cost for the cost of the green transition. Hopefully this will push us towards a very realistic attitude to how do we invest money to create better sustainability. There can be implications for broader sustainability themes without the economy, but that we can perhaps leave for the follow-up question.
So to just follow up on that, it sounds like the way you're describing the check on green government, it sounds like that the investments in sustainability might shift towards more efficient functionality or efficient investments, where that green technologies might have to hit ROI relative to their sort of non-green competition and do so without a subsidy sort of baked in. But those technologies might have a chance, but only those. Is that sort of the proposed future you're thinking of?
I think it's definitely a possibility. Now, so far, the green imperative is an overarching imperative which will continue to push government funding into it. But I think it will definitely be the case that those green technologies that can meet positive ROIs and compete or get close to competing with non-green technologies will be preferred. And there will be a weeding out of those that cannot. And it will be very difficult and very challenging for both the governments and private entities to try to figure out, okay, which green technologies, which are potentially very innovative, potentially groundbreaking, but are not profitable yet, which ones should we continue to push now, even if they're not profitable today, because they could be game-changing tomorrow? That choice will be one of the hardest that we face.
To follow up on that, I think you just restated at the end, it sounds like then so short-term investments and short-term visibility for at least the private sector or private investment might look different from government. And we will have to sort of in the future, maybe in the near term, sort out that difference of what government's role is in terms of investing in sort of high-risk long-term support and maybe possibly be more selective with that because of the harder nature of that trade-off. Is that fair?
That's exactly correct. That's a very good way of characterizing it, yes.
So then sort of following on that, sort of within sort of the government policies in terms of investment and sort of getting manufacturing across or, you know, imports, et cetera, do you think that this, you know, shift towards a greater inflation is going to have, you know, or exacerbate protectionism, like possibly the tariffs we saw under recent administrations in the U.S.? What happens to supply chains in this sort of tightened or heightened scrutiny?
I think that the push towards protectionism will continue. It's now longstanding. You mentioned the increase in tariffs under recent administrations. That's a striking example. But protectionism, including through non-tariff barriers, had been increasing for a while before that, and not just in the US and Europe, but across the world. And I think we will see more rounds of protectionist measures. We will see more rounds, for example, of the imposition of local content requirements when the recent Inflation Reduction Act had a lot of it. There are different reasons for this. Some of it is the squeeze that comes from inflation. Some of it is the need to prioritize domestic economic development. So you have governments developing some sympathy, again, some renewed sympathy for policies of, essentially for some forms of industrial strategy, right? And it's an interesting one because as an economist, I tend to see most industrial policies as bound to fail. But it's also undeniable that, for example, in the US, globalization has gone hand in hand with a fair degree of deindustrialization, so the loss of manufacturing jobs in certain areas of the country. So the economic and social impact has been significant. The economic impact is not insignificant, not just because of the loss of jobs and wages, because in the end, you know, as the economy is dynamic, jobs are created somewhere else. But there is, I think, a synergy between manufacturing activity and research and development and innovation, which is quite powerful. So excessive loss of manufacturing can be damaging to innovation. And I think governments are starting to realize that and move against it. There are also strategic desires to have certain manufacturings, think of semiconductors or medical supplies, located within the border. So I think all these forces will continue to push towards more protectionism. Supply chains will continue to adapt both to these forces and to the disruptions or to the risk of disruptions that we have seen over the last several years. Supply chains have been disrupted by the pandemic, by natural disasters, by geopolitical events. And I think companies, earlier I was focusing more on the strategy of governments, but I think corporations, private corporations, are now rethinking the risk-benefit balance of their global supply chains. So we will continue to see a push towards a bit more of localization. I think we will also see companies try to rely more on technology and distributed systems to make their supply chains more resilient and more efficient. For example, we're already seeing a greater reliance on platforms like manufacturing on demand platforms, which again allow companies to diversify the risk and to maximize productive capacity. The use of artificial intelligence for logistics, for inventory management. So I think we will see, we will not move away completely from globalization and globalized supply chains because they deliver an enormous amount of efficiency. So there will still be a push in that direction, but there will be some pull away from it and more attention to the technology solutions that can help make supply chains more resilient and efficient at the same time. And it will take several years, I think, to find a new equilibrium.
So, Marco, following up on James's question, are these tariffs and things really ways to try to recapture some of the kind of extrinsic losses in this kind of global outsourcing? I mean, for example, when you move manufacturing to China, you lose all the know-how. There's a lot of intellectual property. There's a lot of know-how, trade secrets, et cetera, that somehow are offshored as well. And is this really a response to try to create something that could potentially be held in a market way in terms of just compensating, like we would with cap and trade, for some externality that we care about and putting a value?
I think to some extent it is, definitely, because you know, to some extent, tariffs are just traditionally the response to pressure from vested interests, and they end up resulting in higher costs for consumers. So that's something we need to remember. In the end, tariffs tend to be sand in the wheel. They tend to create inefficiency. However, we also have to put them in the context of a global economy, which is not a perfect textbook case free market, especially when you look at big trade partners which don't often operate by the same rules. And it's definitely the case that what we've seen over the past 10, 20 years, together with the outsourcing of jobs, has been also the outsourcing of intellectual ability, the outsourcing of innovation capabilities. And so I definitely think that an element of the push towards protectionism is try to regain some of that, some of those benefits. Now, the trick will be, how do you balance that with the fact that innovation works best in an open market? Innovation works best if ideas can travel, if people can collaborate. So hopefully we can use technology platforms and communication platforms to compensate the protectionism and maintain the level of collaboration, of exchange that is needed not to slow down innovation. Otherwise, there might be some benefit for individual countries, but with a global cost.
So to that point, and maybe I'm double-clicking in on that, we think about that global economic landscape. What if we can double-click into the role that innovation plays in all of this? thinking about the fascinating contrast between autocratic or more directed economies and democratic or more democratized economies with kind of a more robust entrepreneurial kind of community. How might we envision the model of public-private partnership for innovation evolving in order to match pace with the change and de-risk the volatility that we're seeing in markets today and to create more kind of systemic, resilient, and robust economies?
That's an excellent question. So as we were saying earlier, innovation here plays a key role. And I think we should expect significant benefits to accrue from innovation. We talked about the impact on supply chains. I also think digital industrial innovations now are finally beginning to scale. So over the coming years, they should be able to boost productivity growth and put us on a higher growth trajectory, provided we are smart enough to invest more in the education system, in training, so that we can get human capital to keep up with innovations and technology. And provided that we remember that on innovation, we should be optimistic on innovation, but not regard it as a magical solution. But again, you brought up a very interesting contradiction here, which is that on the one hand, there seems to be, and for very understandable reasons, there seems to be increasing support for a more government-driven, centralized, even autocratic approach to economic governance. On the other hand, though, we are all becoming more and more aware of the power of democratized and distributed economic systems. And this is true for us, it's true for governments, it's true for citizens. So I'm hoping, to your question, that this will lead us to some new model of public-private partnership. Maybe one where the government focuses on creating the infrastructure, the enabling conditions, and then governments collaborates with a larger number of smaller entrepreneurial private sector entities that can innovate, experiment, and distribute novel solutions. And this kind of partnership should also include a boost to public investment in basic research and an intensified collaboration between top government research and science agencies and private sector partners. We're already seeing some of this in the space sector. We touched upon this with James earlier, the idea that on sustainability, maybe governments will have to be the ones that go ahead on the more far-reaching, the more far-sighted and risk-taking research and then collaborate with the private sector to get it enacted. I think an approach like this could combine the power of centralized investment and risk-taking at the government level with immense potential and flexibility of distributed systems. It's going to be tough to get the balance right on both sides. I've described an ideal scenario. Hopefully, we'll move in that direction. But if we do, it will be a very volatile process full of errors and missteps. But you know, the eventual benefits could be huge.
If I could follow up on that, Marco. So you mentioned in a, you know, a prior statement around sort of the drive towards resilience. And I think we can all agree post-pandemic that supply chain resilience has become sort of a key focus for a lot of players. You mentioned the semiconductors specifically, and I think that's a great use case. It seems then that sort of resilience innovation, sort of innovating within the idea of how you become more resilient, how you stabilize your supply chain, is a space of innovation, a space where the market right now could possibly improve. And might be the trade-off over maybe achieving a price advantage or competitive advantage in other ways. So do you think that this push post-pandemic towards resilience, while it might appear to be protectionist, could actually open up innovation opportunities sort of onshore or within the US, like semiconductors? I assume, yes, manufacturing semiconductors is a very specific industry, but I assume also that where those factories are placed in the US, a lot of other supporting industries and the supporting work will come up. Is there an opportunity for innovation to sort of grow out of this shift towards resilience?
Absolutely. And I think in two different ways, and you've touched on both of them, James. One is that by having some level of reshoring driven by protectionism, driven by the need to secure it, as Ed put it earlier, to regain control of some of the benefits of innovation and manufacturing, that will benefit economic growth in different areas of individual countries, in our case in the US. And once that happens, the potential of greater cooperation with local universities, local research centers, the creation of ecosystems of supporting manufacturing activities, the potential to create new innovation hubs is huge, and I think that will pay off in terms of leveraging new pockets of human capital and having a more distributed base of innovation, and by definition will give you benefits compared to having innovation which is just focused on a few traditional pockets of university and research and industry ecosystems. So that's one way where I think this will be beneficial. The second part related to supply chains, and again, you talked about it, is the following. There is definitely a realization on the part of industries that, okay, our supply chains need to be more resilient. How do we do this? And they're innovating more and more. They're also realizing that this cannot be just a defensive move as it was at the beginning of the pandemic, for example, where what companies did was they went all out in building up inventories. They double booked orders to make sure they had different supply. And so they went into survival mode. But they know that is not a long-term solution. So what follows next is, okay, how do I make my supply chain more efficient and more resilient while being more localized? And then the next step is, okay, how do I regain some of the advantages of globalization? How do I re-globalize a bit my supply chain marginally, incrementally, but in a way that maintains resilience, in a way that maintains the risk under control? And you need innovation for that. So I think this is going to be a tremendous spur to innovation on how companies do business for the supply chain itself, but also for the integration between supply chains, production and distribution, and also I would say R&D and project development and development of products. So
on that note, I mean, you mentioned the reshoring of various industries and how that might be a response, but it seems like that is going to have probably, each country around the world is going to have a different capability of responding to that, given the various demographics, what they can onshore, what they can transition back to, or how they adjust to resilience, depending on what they're manufacturing. So demographics are going to play a huge role in sort of how that plays out. But also, I'm also thinking of sort of your mention earlier about sort of the demographics and the relationship to saving and inflation. So all these things sort of working in concert. We know sort of, a lot of populations are aging around the world in countries like Europe and Japan. Sort of younger generations are just not quite as large. So the workforce relative to the retired population is definitely shifting. And that's a huge problem, especially for societies or countries with sort of strong Social Security schemas and that depend on sort of those new generations to finance really the retirement of older ones. So what do you think the demographics, what impact the demographics will have, on sort of this broader ecosystem shift in the coming years or on innovation and where we head with that, particularly around sort of the aging workforce and the aging populations around the world?
Very important impact. And let me draw some differences across the different geographical areas. If you start with advanced economies that are facing, as you were saying, aging populations, so the first consideration you already made it is that social security pension systems are in trouble because they are essentially, they're designed as pyramid schemes. So they rely on new, larger generations paying the benefits for smaller retiring generations. The moment that relationship between the generations inverts and you have smaller, younger generations having to pay for larger retiring generations, you're in trouble. Now, one compensating factor here, which we tend to forget, is that there is also kind of financial inverted pyramid effect, which is the larger, older generations moving into retirement have a huge set of savings and financial assets in advanced economies that are going to be inherited by the younger generations. So the younger generations, yes, have a bigger burden, but they also have the benefit of the massive transfer of wealth coming from the older generations. Now, in advanced economies, I think the impact of all this is that you will have a massive incentive for older generations to keep working for longer. So increasing retirement ages, hopefully the healthcare system keeps up with this. This would be positive for growth also because older workers tend to be more productive. Experience pays off. The statistics show that older workers tend to increase productivity. The key in advanced economies, I think, is going to keep young generations motivated, hungry, eager to push the limits and push the frontiers of knowledge. And I think this, to me, is the bigger risk of aging population in advanced economies. In Europe, we have seen a loss of momentum because of what happens naturally. I think it is human nature. As societies get richer, it becomes harder to keep younger generations motivated. In Europe, we have seen it clearly. It results in a decline in growth rates. In the US, this has been avoided mostly through immigration. But, you know, immigration needs to be managed and needs to be managed in a way that continues to be a growth engine. So this is for advanced economies. Around the world, China, I think, is the one that should be most worried because it's now starting to get old before it gets rich. So the worsening demographics are very significant. China is also getting old in a situation where it doesn't yet have a serious and reliable social safety net. So the aging of the population could seriously curb China's economic growth, which would be a blow to its geopolitical ambitions. So this is something that could have serious economic and geopolitical consequences. Then you look at the other giant, India. India has strong demographic benefits to reap. If it continues to implement economic reforms, then it can accelerate growth and continue to catch up with China. And Africa is the other large area with a huge demographic potential. But in the case of Africa, I think this can be either a major blessing or a major curse, because with some improvement in governance and institution, Africa can be the next huge success economic story. Without it, the tensions with Europe related to immigration are going to become a political, economic, and geopolitical nightmare. So to go back to the core of your question, demographics are going to be a huge, hugely important driver of economic and social developments in the next 10, 20 years.
Okay, I had a related question to James's on demographics. In the past, people have been, you mentioned the increased productivity, the more experienced workforce. But in the past, there was a fear when the, for example, women entered the workforce or when younger generation entering the workforce, it actually helped the productivity because it deburdened some of the older generation. There was actually an increase in productivity from this addition to the women, in addition to participation. But I'm wondering, going forward, when you start to have not just humans, but now you start to have machine learning, AI, robotic autonomy entering into the mix, what does that do to the economy, to the workforce?
It's a very good point, Vic. First of all, your observation is exactly right. That is, in a situation where new technologies play a bigger role, then the experience impact on productivity can be, if not reversed, muted. That is, younger generations might not have the experience, but they will be more conversant with new technologies, and probably they will be able to master new technologies faster, which provides a productivity advantage. I think the introduction of new technologies, including robotics, including artificial intelligence, automation, can give a huge boost to productivity. So once this is done well and really gains traction, this is something that I personally believe will be transformational for productivity. That is, it's something that can boost productivity by at least 1-2 percentage points or more and offset any headwinds that we have from demographics. It is, however, very hard to do, because we tend to get very excited about the breakthroughs in technology, and they are real. But making these breakthroughs in technology, first of all, foolproof and error-free so that they can actually be implemented in industrial settings, and then getting different sectors of the economy to adopt the new technologies in a way that requires changing processes, changing management practices, compensation schemes, etc., is also a considerable headwind. So as my answer to your question, Vic, would be, as these new technologies permeate the economic system, the positive impact on productivity will be huge, and it will offset any headwinds we have from the demographics, but it might take longer than we think for these benefits to actually accrue.
So, Marco, in a slight change from that, over the last 50 years, the free market system has pulled 2 billion people out of poverty. But in the developed countries, there seems to be a push away from kind of a fully free market system. What do you think the future looks like, and what is the best path forward?
I think the future looks complicated. As you said, the benefits that the free market system has given us are huge. Billions of people out of poverty, increases in the standards of living all over the world. At the same time, the free market system is not perfect, right? We've seen increases in inequality. We've seen in some countries declines in some health standards. We've seen, I personally look at the primacy that financial markets have achieved now in the US and Europe. They seem to have become the tail that wags the dog and pushes economic policy. There's a push for excess consumption under the free market that by many measures looks unsustainable. So there are various reasons that justify these measures of dissatisfaction with the current level of management, the current system of free market. Now, it worries me for the following reason. I tend to think that what we should do is take a hard look at where the free market has underperformed and think seriously of what tweaks we can implement to make it better. It's a system that has always been evolving. I think I'm worried that the temptation is always going to be more simplistic, which is to say, well, we should move closer to something that looks more like a government-driven economy, something which is more like a centralized system, like a socialist economy. And we know that the classic socialist systems have failed miserably and repeatedly. So we should definitely not go down that route. So I hope that we will go down in the route of having some course corrections to the current free market system. I am worried that, as is always the case, we will overreact first. So as I mentioned earlier, we'll take further steps towards greater government intervention, more government expenditures, more taxation, and then we'll realize, hey, this is not what we wanted to do at all. And so we will correct course again back towards hopefully a more efficient free market system.
So thanks for that question, Ed. And this circling back to the sort of the demographics, I'm trying to put what Vic was mentioning about sort of AI and demographics and sort of Ed's question all in a thread together. So we've got this emerging trend of AI and hopefully sort of greater productivity, you know, driven by hopefully sort of better use of AI and technology within the free market context. We've also got sort of this aging demographic, you know, shift where people are living longer. There's also more people living longer. Who are in those sort of later stages who may not be digital natives and may not be able to sort of stay within the workforce as long. And similarly, we've seen over, you know, I don't think anyone argues, so we've seen a shift over the last few years to, you know, more of that gig economy, the 1099, over trying to, you know, what people might call sort of optimize around flexibility. But I'm not sure that everyone on a 1099 wants to be there and wouldn't prefer the stability and structure and predictability of a W-2. So it seems like all of these things are shaping more the developed economies, as you mentioned, than the sort of emerging economies, because they have more access to these sort of structures and they're sort of running up against the limits. What are the examples sort of within sort of the free market pivots or tweaks that you think are sort of going to happen sooner rather than later that hopefully, you know, won't be these big shifts, these overreactions that you talk about? What are maybe the small pivots or small options that are out there for us?
I think, first of all, this is certainly what I hope to see, is increasing adoption of technologies that help workers at all skill levels in the workplace, right? We've already seen examples of use of augmented reality or virtual reality to give workers in industry and manufacturing just-in-time learning and training on how to perform difficult operations. And that is enormously productivity improving, and it also helps access to the workforce. I'm also hoping that new technologies, you know, we hear a lot about ChatGPT and new forms of natural communication between artificial intelligence and humans. That should actually make it easier for older generations to have access to the potential of new technologies. So I'm hoping to see technology used more and more on the workplace to allow workers of all skill levels and age profiles to contribute productively. These should also, to your point of the 1099 and W-2, should also help accommodate workers who have different preferences and different priorities for the kind of flexibility or full-time engagement they want. And the enable them to match their skills to their preferences for whether to work part-time or full-time, and match those to the need of corporations. So a system that then also develops more of an ecosystem distributed workforce approach that creates, it's almost like a better use of productive capacity. Like we talk about it in the case of on-demand manufacturing platforms. We can have something similar here that allows companies to have better access to human capital and at the same time optimize the potential of human capital within an advanced economy, both from the point of view of the economy and from the point of view of workers themselves. It's going to be a difficult adjustment, but I think if we take it seriously and if we really invest more attention and more time and capital in skills building and education, I think with the new technologies that are becoming available now, the potential to get this right is just huge. And we're starting from a position of strength where unemployment is at a 50-year record low. So we're starting from a position where there is a need for workers of all kinds, of all specialties. And so it's exactly the right time to get workers of all levels entrenched in the right way in the productive system.
Marco, a little bit different direction here. So a lot of the things we've been talking about are future looking. And I'm wondering if we look back, back even over the last several decades, there have been some countries that have weathered financial crises better than others. And I'm wondering, are there any models out there that we can look at that in the context of looking forward, that we can look at and say, maybe these are models that we might emulate? Or are the differences between the countries so structurally different that it's not applicable to the U.S.?
No, I think the lesson that you draw from how different countries have weathered financial crises tell you the following. The secret is always, one, to maintain a high degree of flexibility in your economy. Two, which is almost an offshoot of this, avoid the risk of, for example, zombie companies or zombie banks. So when you have a financial crisis, look around and companies or financial institutions that can't stand up on their own should probably be let go, especially if in a context of, as you said, future looking and looking at how the economy and technology are changing, we're looking at companies and sectors that anyway don't look like they have a strong potential going forward. So I think the lesson that came from the past experience with financial crisis is be as brutal as possible with a productive system, let the creative destruction happen and then the creative construction happen, and focus government help on individuals, on households, on workers to help them when they are unemployed, help them retrain. I think that is absolutely the biggest lesson in looking at the financial crisis in the past. The second one that I would add, Vic, is I mentioned earlier, I'm a little bit worried that the financial system in the U.S. is taking an outsized role, and it's becoming almost the biggest preoccupation of policymakers. And I think we need to think a little bit more of how we make it more resilient, more and less all-powerful than it is today. And so a system that no longer has the potential of dragging down the entire economy, no longer has to be the priority for the Federal Reserve, and at the same time continues to function as a source of capital efficiency and savings investment for both corporations and households. For this, there is no historical precedent. I think this is a challenge which the U.S. is the first country to face, but I think it's a very important challenge to think through.
Thanks, Marco. And my goodness, clearly a lot to consider here. And with that, we're going to need to wrap it up for this episode. So much to unpack, and I think we've done pretty good job bringing a lot of these themes to the surface here. We're going to be revisiting these important themes throughout the series, where we will be joined by thought leaders, market makers, academics, futurists, scientists, and economists, who are going to help us better understand the work, worldviews, and ecosystemic impacts shaping our society, economy, and the world around us. So if you like the sound of this, please just subscribe to the podcast, follow the website through to the link in the profile. And gentlemen, and everyone joining us here today, thank you so much, and we'll see you on the next episode.